Green Mars, Cassette 15.
All the principal figures in Nicosia that night have been accused of being behind the assassination. Russell and Hoyle on the basis of political imaginary. But certainly the most suspicion over the years has fallen on the figure of Frank Chalmers, though he was observed on the basis of political quarrels either real or imaginary. But certainly the most suspicion over the years has fallen on the figure of Frank Chalmers, though he was observed to be with Teutovna at the time of the attack, which in some theories gets Teutovna called an accessory or co-conspirator. His relationship with the Egyptians and Saudis in Nicosia make it inevitable that he is often identified as the ultimate cause of Boone's murder. Few, if any, deny that Selim El Hail was the leader of the three Arabs who eventually confessed before their suicide murders. But this only adds to suspicion of Chalmers, as he was a known acquaintance of El Hail's. Samizdat and One Reed documents are reputed to tell the story that the stowaway was in Nicosia and spotted Chalmers and El Hail in conversation that night. As the stowaway is a myth mechanism by which people convey the anonymous perceptions of the common Martian, it's quite possible that such a tale expresses the observations of people who did not want to be identified as witnesses. Maya clicked to the end. El Hail was in the late stages of a fatal paroxysm when he broke into the hotel occupied by the Egyptians and confessed to the murder of Boone, asserting that he had been the leader, but had been aided by Rashid Abu and Bulan Basiso of the Ahad wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. The bodies of Abu and Basiso were found later that afternoon in a room in the Medina, poisoned by coagulants that appeared to be self-administered or given to each other. The actual murderers of Boone were dead. Why they acted and with whom they may have acted will never be known. Not the first time such a situation has existed, and not the last, for we hide as much as we seek. Scrolling through footnotes, Maya was struck again by what a topic this was, debated by historians and scholars and conspiracy nuts of every persuasion. With a shudder of revulsion, she tapped the lectern off and faced the double window and shut her eyes hard, trying to restore the Frank she had known and the Boone. For years she had scarcely ever thought of John, the pain was so great, and in a different way she hadn't wanted to think of Frank either. Now she wanted them back. The pain had become the ghost of pain, and she needed to have them back for her own life's sake. She needed to know. The mythical stowaway. She ground her teeth, feeling the weightless hallucinatory fear of that first sight of him, his brown face distorted and big-eyed through the glass. Did he know anything? Had he really been in Nicosia? Desmond Hawkins, the stowaway, the coyote. He was a strange man. Maya had never been able to talk to him well. Hard to say if she would be able now that she needed to, but she doubted it. "What is it?" she had asked Frank when they heard the shouting. A hard shrug, a look away, something done on the spur of the moment. Where had she heard that before? He had looked away as he said it, as if he couldn't bear her gaze, as if he had somehow said too much. The mountain ranges ringing the Hellas Basin were widest in the western crescent called the Hellespontus Montes, the range on Mars most reminiscent of Terran Mountains. To the north, where the piste from Sabishii and Burrows crossed into the basin, the range was narrower and lower, not so much a matter of mountainous terrain as of an uneven drop to the basin floor, the land seemingly shoved to the north in low, concentric waves. The piste threaded its way down this hilly slope, and often it had to switch back down long ramps cut into the sides of the rock waves, each new one lower than the last. The train slowed greatly for the turns, and for many minutes at a time Maya could look out her window either straight at the bare basalt of the wave they were descending, or out over a big expanse of northwest Hellas, still 3,000 meters below them. A wide, flat plain, ochre and olive and khaki in the foreground, then out on the horizon a dirty jumble of white winking like a broken mirror. That was the glacier over Low Point, still mostly frozen, but thawing more each year with melt ponds on its surface and deeper pods of water far below, pods which teemed with life and occasionally broke onto the surface of the ice or even the adjacent land, for this lobe of ice was growing fast. They were pumping water out of aquifers below the surrounding mountains onto the basin floor. The deep depression in the northwest part of the basin, where Low Point and the Mohole had been, was the center of this new sea, which was over 1,000 kilometers long and, at its widest over Low Point, 300 kilometers across, and situated in the lowest point on Mars. A situation rich with promise, as Maya had been maintaining from the very moment they had landed. The town Odessa had been established well up the north slope of the basin, at the -1 kilometer elevation, where they planned to stabilize the final level of the sea. Thus it was a harbor town waiting for water, and with that in mind, the southern edge of the town was a long boardwalk or corniche, a wide grassy esplanade that ran inside the tent, which was secured in the edge of a tall seawall that now stood above bare land. The view of the seawall as the train approached gave one the impression that it was a half-town with a southern part that had split off and disappeared. Then the train was coasting into the town's train station and the view was cut off. The train stopped and Maya pulled down her bag and walked out, following Spencer. They didn't look at each other, but once out of the station they went with a loose group of people to a tram stop and got on the same little blue tram which ran behind the Cornish Park bordering the seawall. Near the west end of town, they both got off at the same stop. There, behind and above an open-air market shaded by plane trees, was a 3-story apartment complex inside a walled courtyard with young cypresses lining the side walls. Each floor of the building stepped back from the one below so that there were balconies for the 2 higher levels, sporting potted trees and flower boxes hung on their railings. As she climbed the stairs up to the gate of the courtyard, Maya found the architecture of the building somewhat reminiscent of Nadia's buried arcades. But up here in the late afternoon sun behind the market, its walls whitewashed and its shutters blue, it had the look of the Mediterranean or the Black Sea. Not all that unlike some fashionable seaside apartment blocks in Terra's Odessa. At the gate, she turned to look back over the plane trees of the market. The sun was setting over the Hellespontus Mountains to the west, and out on the distant ice, blinks of sunlight gleamed as yellow as butter. She followed Spencer through the garden and into the building, checked in with the concierge right after he did, got her key, and went to the apartment that had been assigned to her. The whole building belonged to Praxis, and some apartments functioned as safe houses, including hers and no doubt Spencer's. They got in the elevator together and went to the 3rd floor, not speaking. Maya's apartment was 4 doors down from Spencer's. She went inside. 2 spacious rooms, one with a kitchen nook, a bathroom, an empty balcony. The view from the kitchen window overlooked the balcony and the distant ice. She put her bag on the bed and went back out, down to the market to buy dinner. She bought from vendors with carts and umbrellas and sat on a bench placed on the grass bordering the corniche, eating souvlaki and drinking from a little bottle of Retsina, watching the evening crowd make their leisurely promenade up and down the corniche. The closest edge of the ice sea looked to be about 40 kilometers away, and now all but the easternmost part of the ice was in the shadow of the Hellespontus, a dusky blue shading in the east to alpenglow pink. Spencer sat down beside her on the bench. "Nice view," he remarked. She nodded and continued eating. She offered him the bottle of Retsina, and he said, "No, thank you," holding up a half-eaten tamale. She nodded and swallowed. "What are you working on?" she asked when she was done. "Parts for sacks, bioceramics, among other things."
"For Biotique?"
"For a sister company. She makes seashells."
"What?"
"It's the name of the company, another Praxis division."
"Speaking of Praxis," she glanced at him.
"Yes, Sachs wants these parts pretty bad."
For weapons?
Yes. She shook her head. Can you keep him on a leash for a while?
I can try.
They watched the sunlight drain out of the sky, flowing westward like a liquid. Behind them, lights flicked on in the trees over the market, and the air began to chill. Maya felt grateful that there was an old friend sitting beside her in comfortable silence. Spencer's behavior toward her made a telling contrast to Sack's. In his friendliness was his apology for his recriminations in the car after Cassay Vallis, and his forgiveness for what she had done to Phyllis. She appreciated it. And in any case, he was one of the primal family, and it was nice to have that during yet another move, a new start, a new city, a new life. How many was it now?
Did you know Frank very well? She said.
Not really. Not like you and John knew him.
Do you think he could have been involved in John's murder?
Spencer continued to look out at the blue ice on the black horizon. Finally, he took the retsina bottle from the bench beside her. Drank. He looked at her. Does it matter anymore?
She had spent many of the early years working in the Hellas Basin, convinced as she had been that its low elevation was going to make it an obvious site for settlement. Now the land just above the -1 kilometer contour was being settled in places all around the basin, places she had been among the first to explore. She had her old notes on them in her AI, and now, as Ludmila Novosibirskaya, she got to put them to use. Her job was in the administration of the hydrological company that was flooding the basin. The team was part of a conglomerate of organizations developing the basin, among them the Black Sea Economic Group's oil companies, the Russian company that had tried to resuscitate the Caspian and Aral Seas, and her company, Deepwaters, which was Praxis-owned. Maya's job involved coordinating the many hydrological operations in the region, so again she got to see the heart of the Hellas project, just as in the old days when she had been the driving force behind the entire thing. This was satisfying in various ways, some of them strange. For instance, her town, Low Point, a mistaken sighting, she had to admit, was out there getting drowned deeper every day. That was fine. Drown the past, drown the past, drown the past. So she had her work and her apartment, which she filled with used furniture and hanging kitchen implements and potted plants. And Odessa proved to be a pleasant town. It was built principally of yellow stone and brown tile, and placed on a part of the slope of the basin rim that curved inward more than usual, so that every part of town looked down on the center of the dry waterfront, and every part had a great view over the basin to the south. The lower districts were devoted to shops and business and parks, the higher ones to residential neighborhoods and garden strips. The town lay just above 30 degrees latitude in the south, and so she had gone from autumn to spring with the big hot sun shining down the stepped streets of the upper town and melting away the winter's snow from the ice mass's edge and the peaks of the Hellespontus Mountains on their western horizon. A handsome little town. And about a month after her arrival, Michelle came down from Sabishi and took over the apartment right next door to hers. At her suggestion, he installed a connecting door between their two living rooms, and after that they wandered between the two apartments as if in one, living their lives in a conjugal domesticity which Maya had never experienced before, a normality that she found very restful. She didn't love Michelle passionately, but he was a good friend, a good lover, and a good therapist, and having him around was like having an anchor inside her, keeping her from flying away into exhilarations of hydrology or revolutionary fervor, also from sinking too deep into terrible abysses of political despair or personal repugnance. Cycling up and down the sine wave of her moods was a helpless oscillation that she hated, and anything Michelle did in the way of amplitude modulation she appreciated. They kept no mirrors in the apartments, which, along with clomipramine, helped to dampen the cycle. But the bottoms of pots and the windows at night gave her the bad news if she cared to have it, as often enough she did. With Spencer down the hall, the building had just the slightest feeling of Underhill to it, reinforced occasionally by visitors from out of town using their apartment in its capacity as safe house. When others of the first 100 came through, they would go out and walk the waterless waterfront, looking at the ice horizon and exchanging the news like old folks anywhere. Mars First, led by Cassay and Dow, was becoming more and more radical. Peter was working on the elevator, drawn like a moth back to its moon. Sachs had stopped his mad écotage campaign for the time being, thank God, and was concentrating on his industrial effort in Vishniac Mohol, building surface-to-space missiles and the like. Maya shook her head at this news. It wasn't military might that would do it for them. On that issue, she sided with Nadia and Nirgal and Art. They would need something else, something she couldn't yet visualize. And this gap in her thinking was one of the things that would start her downward in the sine wave of her moods, one of the things that made her mad. Her work coordinating the various aspects of the flooding project began to get interesting. She trammed or walked down to the offices in the center of town, and there worked hard to process all the reports sent in by the many dowsing crews and drilling operations, all full of glowing estimates of the amounts of water they might put into the basin, and all accompanied by requests for more equipment and personnel, until altogether they added up to much more than deep waters could supply. Judging the competing claims was difficult from the office, and her technical staff usually just rolled their eyes and shrugged. "It's like judging a liar's contest," one said. And then also, reports were coming in from all around the basin of the new settlements under construction, and by no means all of the people building these settlements came from the Black Sea Group or the Metanats involved with them. A lot of them were simply unidentified. One of her dowsing crews would note the presence of a tent town which had no official existence and leave it at that. And the two big canyon projects in Dow Vallis and the Dow Rule System were clearly populated by many more people than could be accounted for in the official documentation. People who must therefore be living under assumed identities like her, or else living out of the net entirely, which was very interesting indeed. A circumhellous piece had just been completed the year before, a difficult piece of engineering, as the rim of the basin was riven by cracks and ridges and cratered by a heavy dose of ejecta re-entry. But now the piece was in place, and Maya decided to satisfy her curiosity by taking a trip out to inspect all the deep waters projects in person and look into some of the new settlements. To accompany her on this trip, she requested the company of one of their aerologists, a young woman named Diana, whose reports had been coming in from the East Basin. Her reports were terse and unremarkable, but Maya had learned from Michelle that she was the child of Esther's son, Paul. Esther had had Paul very soon after leaving Zygote, and as far as Maya knew, she had never told anyone who Paul's father was. So it could have been Esther's husband Cassay, in which case Diana was Jackie's niece and John and Hiroko's great-granddaughter. Or else it could have been Peter, as many supposed, in which case she was Jackie's half-niece and Anne and Simon's great-granddaughter. Either way, Maya found it intriguing, and in any case, the young woman was one of the Yonsei, a fourth-generation Martian, and as such, interesting to Maya no matter what her ancestry. Interesting also in her own right, as it turned out when Maya met her in the Odessa offices a few days before their trip. With her great size, over 2 meters tall and yet very rounded and muscular, and her fluid grace and her high-cheekboned Asiatic features, she seemed a member of a new race, there to keep Maya company in this new corner of the world. It turned out that Diana was completely obsessed with the Hellas Basin and its hidden water, and she talked about it for hours, at such length and in such detail, that Maya became convinced that the mystery of parentage was solved. Such a Mars maniac must be related to Anne Claiborne, and so it followed that Paul had been fathered by Peter.
Maya sat in the train seat beside the big young woman, watching her or looking out the window at the steep northern slope of the basin, asking questions, observing as Diana shifted her knees against the seat back in front of her. They didn't make train seats big enough for the natives. One thing that fascinated Diana was that the Hellas Basin had proved to be ringed by much more underground water than had been predicted by the aerological models. This discovery, made in the field over the last decade, had inspired the current Hellas Project, turning the hypothetical sea from a nice idea into a tangible possibility. It had also forced the aerologists to reconsider their theoretical models of early Martian history and caused people to start looking around the rims of the other big impact basins on the planet. Reconnaissance expeditions were underway in the Caridim and Nereidium Montes encircling Argyre and in the hills ringing South Isidus. Around Hellas itself, they were near to completing the inventory, and they had found perhaps 30 million cubic meters all told, though some dowsers argued they were by no means finished. "Is there a way to know when they're finished?" Maya asked Diana, thinking about all the requests for resources flooding her office. Diana shrugged. "After a while, you've just looked everywhere. What about the basin floor itself? Might the flooding be destroying our ability to get to some aquifers out there?" "No." "Almost no water," she told Maya, "was located under the basin floor itself. The floor had been desiccated by the original impact, and now it consisted of about a kilometer's depth of aeolian sediment, underlain by a hard cake of brecciated rock, formed during the brief but stupendous pressures of the impact. These same pressures had also caused deep fracturing all around the rim of the basin, and it was this fracturing that had allowed unusually large amounts of outgassing from the interior of the planet. Volatiles from below had seeped up and cooled, and the water portion of the volatiles had pooled in liquid aquifers and in many zones of highly saturated permafrost." "Quite an impact," Maya observed. "It was big, all right." "As a general rule," Diana said, "impactors were about one-tenth the size of the crater or basin they made, like historical figures," Maya thought. "So the impacting planetesimal in this case had been a body about 200 kilometers in diameter coming down on ancient cratered highland terrain. Signature traces of it indicated it had probably been an ordinary asteroid, carbonaceous chondrite for the most part, with lots of water and some nickel iron in it. It had had a speed on arrival of about 72,000 kilometers per hour and had hit at a slightly eastward angle, which explained the huge devastated region east of Hellas, as well as the high, relatively well-organized concentric ridges of the Hellespontus Montes to the west." Then Diana described another rule of thumb which caused Maya to free associate analogies to human history. "The bigger an impactor, the less of it survived the impact. Thus, almost every bit of this one had vaporized in the cataclysmic strike, though there was a small gravitational bolide under Gledhill Crater, which some aerologists claimed was almost certainly the buried remainder of the planetesimal, perhaps 1/10,000th of the original or less, which they claimed would supply all the iron and nickel that they would ever need if they cared to go digging for it." "Is that feasible?" Maya asked. "Not really. Cheaper just to mine the asteroids." Which they were doing, Maya thought darkly. That was what a prison sentence meant now under the latest UNTA regime. Years in the asteroid belt, operating the very strictly circumscribed mining ships and robots. Efficient, the transitional authority said. Prisons that were both remote and profitable. But Diana was still thinking about the basin's awesome birth. The impact had occurred about 3.5 billion years before the present, when the planet's lithosphere had been thinner and its interior hotter. Energies released by the impact were hard to imagine. The total energy created by humanity through all history was as nothing to it. And so the resulting volcanic activity had been considerable. Surrounding Hellas were a number of ancient volcanoes which just postdated the impact, including Australis Tholis to the southwest, Amphitrites Patera to the south, and Hadriaca Patera and Tirrhena Patera to the northeast. All of these volcanic regions had been found to have liquid water aquifers near them. Two of these aquifers had burst onto the surface in ancient times, leaving on the eastern slope of the basin two characteristic sinuous water-carved valleys, Dow Vallis, originating on the corrugated slopes of Hadriaca Patera, and farther south, a linked pair of valleys known as the Harmakis Rule System, which extended for a full 1,000 kilometers. The aquifers at the heads of these valleys had refilled over the eons since their outbreaks, and now big construction crews had tented Dow and were working on Harmakis Rule and were letting the water from the aquifers run down the long enclosed canyons to outlets on the basin floor. Maya was extremely interested in these big new additions to the habitable surface, and Diana, who knew them well, was going to take her to visit some friends in Dow. Their train glided along the northern rim of Hellas for all the first day, with the ice in view on the basin floor almost continually. They passed a little hillside town called Sebastopol, its stone walls Florentine yellow in the afternoon, and after that came to Hell's Gate, the town at the bottom end of Dow Vallis. They walked out of the Hell's Gate train station late in the afternoon and looked down into a big new tent town located under an enormous suspension bridge. The bridge supported the train piece spanning Dow Vallis just up from the canyon's mouth so that its towers were over 10 kilometers apart. From the canyon rim by the bridge, where the train station was, they could see down the widening mouth of the canyon onto the basin floor, stretching out under a lattice of kinky, sun-stained clouds. In the other direction, there was a view well up into the steep, narrow world of the canyon proper. As they walked down a stared and switchbacked street into the town, the new tenting over the canyon was visible only as a certain red haze to the color of the evening sky, the result of a dusting of fines on the tenting materials. "We'll go upstream tomorrow by way of the Rim Road," Diana said, "and get an overview. Then come back down on the canyon floor so you can see what it's like down there." They descended the street, which had 700 numbered steps. In Hell's Gate's downtown, they walked around and had dinner and then climbed back up to the Deep Waters office, which was on the valley wall just under the bridge. They stayed in rooms there, and next morning they went to a garage by the train station and borrowed a small company rover. Diana took the wheel and drove them northeast, paralleling the canyon rim on a road that ran next to the massive concrete foundation for the canyon's tenting. Even though the fabrics were diaphanous to the point of vanishing, the sheer size of the roof made it a heavy weight to anchor. The concrete bulk of the foundation blocked their view down into the canyon itself, and so when they came to the first overlook, Maya hadn't seen into it since Hell's Gate. Diana drove into a little parking lot up on the broad foundation itself, and they parked and put on helmets and got out of the car and walked up a wooden staircase that seemed to ascend freestanding into the sky, although a closer look revealed first the clear aerogel beam supporting the staircase and then the layers of tenting stretching away from their beam to others that couldn't be seen. At the top of the stairs was a small railed viewing platform with a prospect that gave a view of the canyon for many kilometers both upstream and downstream. And there was indeed a stream. The floor of Dow Vallis had a river in it. The canyon floor was dotted with green, or to be more precise, a collection of greens. Maya identified tamarisk, cottonwood, aspen, cypress, sycamore, scrub oak, snow bamboo, sage, and then, on the steep talus and boulder slopes footing the canyon walls, many varieties of shrubs and low creepers, and, of course, sedge and moss and lichen. And running through this exquisite arboretum, a river. It was not a blue stream with white rapids. The water in slower stretches was opaque and the color of rust. In the rapids and waterfalls, it foamed bright shades of pink. Classic Martian tones caused, Diana said, by the fines that were suspended in the water like glacial silt, also by the reflected color of the sky, which was today a kind of hazy mauve, going lavender around the veiled sun, as yellow as the iris of a tiger's eye. But no matter the color of the water, it was a running river in an obviously riverine valley, placid in some places, agitated in others, with gravel fords, sandbars, braided sections, crumbling lemniscate islands, there a big, deep, lazy oxbow, frequent rapids, and far upstream a couple of small falls. Under the tallest waterfall, they could see the pink foam turn almost white, and patches of white were then carried downstream to catch on boulders and snags sticking out from the bank. Dow River, Diana said, also called the Ruby River by the people who live down there. How many are there? A few thousand. Most live pretty close to Hell's Gate. Upstream, there are family homesteads and the like, and of course, then the aquifer station at the head of the canyon where a few hundred of them work. It's one of the biggest aquifers? Yes, about 3 million cubic meters of water, so we're pumping it out at a flow rate. Well, you see it there. About 100,000 cubic meters a year. So in 30 years, no more river? Right. Although they could pump some water back upstream in a pipe and let it out again. Or who knows, if the atmosphere gets humid enough, the slopes of Hadriaca might collect a snowpack big enough to serve as a watershed. Then the river would fluctuate with the seasons, but that's what rivers do, don't they? Maya stared down at the scene which looked so much like something from her youth, some river. The Upper Rioni in Georgia? The Colorado, seen once on a visit to America? She couldn't recall. So fuzzy, all that life. It's beautiful, and so... She shook her head. The sight had a quality she couldn't recall ever seeing before, as if it were out of time, a prophetic glimpse into a distant future. Here, let's go up the road a bit further and see Hadriaca. Maya nodded, and they returned to the car. Once or twice as they continued uphill, the road rose far enough above the foundation to give them another view down onto the canyon floor, and Maya saw that the little river continued to cut through rocks and vegetation. But Diana didn't pause, and Maya saw no sign of settlements. At the upper end of the tented canyon, there was a big concrete block of a physical plant, housing the gas exchange mechanisms and the pumping station. A forest of windmills stood on the rising slope to the north of this station, the big props all facing west and slowly spinning. Above that array rose the broad, low cone of Hadriaca Patera, a volcano whose sides were unusually furrowed by a dense crisscrossing network of lava channels, the later ones cutting over the earlier ones. Now the winter's snowpack had filled the channels, but not the exposed black rock between them, which had been blown clear by the strong winds accompanying the snowstorms. The result was an enormous black cone sticking into the bruised sky, festooned with hundreds of tangled white ribbons. "Very handsome," Maya said. "Can they see it from the canyon floor?" "No, but a lot of them at this end work up on the rim anyway, at the well or the power station, so they see it every day." "These settlers, who are they?" "Let's go meet them and see," Diana said. Maya nodded, enjoying Diana's style, which still reminded her a bit of Anne. The Sansay and Yonsei were all strange to Maya, but Diana much less than most, a bit private perhaps, but compared to her more exotic contemporaries and the Zygote kids, welcomely ordinary. While Maya observed Diana thinking this, Diana drove their rover into the canyon, down a steep road laid over a giant ancient talus slope near the head of Dow. This was where the original aquifer outburst had occurred, but there was very little chaotic terrain, just titanic talus slopes permanently settled at the angle of repose. The canyon floor itself was basically flat and unbroken. Soon they were driving down it on a regolith track sprayed with a fixative. The track ran by the stream where it could.
After about an hour's driving, they passed a green meadow tucked into the lazy curve of a fat oxbow. In the center of this meadow, in a knot of pinyon pine and aspen, huddled a gathering of low shingled roofs with faint smoke rising from a solitary chimney. Maya stared at the settlement, corral and pasture, truck garden, barn, bee boxes, marveling at its beauty and its archaic wholeness, its seeming detachment from the great red rock desert plateau above the canyon, detachment from everything, really, from history, from time itself. A mesocosm. What did they think in those little buildings of Mars and Earth and all their troubles? Why should they care? Diana stopped the car, and a few people came out and crossed the meadow to see who they were. Pressure under the tent was 500 millibars, which helped to support the weight of the tenting, as the atmosphere at large was averaging about 250 millibars now. So Maya popped the lock of the car and got out without her helmet on, feeling undressed and uncomfortable. These settlers were all young natives. Most of them had come down in the last few years from Burrows and Elysium. Some Terrans lived in the valley, too, they said. Not many, but there was a Praxis program that brought up groups from smaller countries, and here in the valley they had recently welcomed some Swiss and Greeks and Navajo. And there was a Russian settlement down near Hell's Gate. So they heard some different languages in the valley, but English was the lingua franca and the first tongue of almost all the natives. They had accents to their English that Maya hadn't heard before, and made odd mistakes in grammar, at least to her ear. Almost every verb after the first one was in present tense, for instance. "We went downstream and see some Swiss are working on the river, stabilizing the banks in some places with plants or rocks. They say in a few years the stream bed is flushed enough for the water to clear." Maya said, "It will still be the color of the cliffs and the sky." "Yeah, of course, but clear water looks better than silty water somehow." "How do you know?" Maya inquired. They squinted and frowned, thinking about it. "Just from the way it looks in your hand, eh?" Maya smiled. "It's wonderful you have so much room. Unbelievable what big spaces they can roof these days, isn't it?" They shrugged as if they hadn't thought of it that way. One said, "We looked forward to the day when we take the tenting off, actually. We missed the rain and the wind." "How do you know?" But they knew. She and Diana drove on, passing very small villages, isolated farms, a pasture of sheep, vineyards, orchards, cultivated fields, big packed greenhouses gleaming like labs. Once a coyote ran across the track ahead of their car. Then, on a high little lawn under a talus slope, Diana spotted a brown bear and later some Dall sheep. In the little villages, people were trading food and tools in open marketplaces and talking over the day's events. They didn't monitor the news from Earth and seemed to Maya astonishingly ignorant of it. All but a little community of Russians who spoke a mongrel Russian which nevertheless brought tears to Maya's eyes, and who told her that things on Earth were falling apart. As usual, they were happy to be in the canyon. In one of the small villages, there was an outdoor market in full swing, and there in the middle of the crowd was Nirgal, chomping an apple and nodding vigorously as someone spoke to him. He saw Maya and Diana get out of the car and rushed over and hugged her, lifting her off the ground. "Maya, what are you doing here?" "On a tour from Odessa. This is Diana, Paul's daughter. What are you doing here?" "Oh, visiting the valley. They've got some soil problems I'm trying to help with." "Tell me about it." Nirgal was an ecological engineer and seemed to have inherited some of Hiroko's talent. The valley mesocosm was relatively new. They were still planting seedlings all up and down it, and though the soil had been prepped, nitrogen and potassium deficiencies were causing many plants not to thrive. As they walked around the marketplace, Nirgal discussed this and pointed out local crops and imported goods, describing the economics of the valley. "So they're not self-sufficient?" Maya asked. No, not even close. But they do grow a lot of their own food and then trade other crops or give them away."
He was working on eco-economics as well, it seemed. And he already had a lot of friends here. People kept coming up to hug him, and as he had his arm over Maya's shoulders, she got pulled into these embraces and then introduced to one young native after another, all of them looking delighted to see Nergal again. He remembered all their names, asked how they were doing, kept up the questions as they continued to circulate through the market, past tables of bread and vegetables and bags of barley and fertilizer and baskets of berries and plums, until there was a whole little crowd of them like a mobile party, which finally settled around long pine tables outside a tavern. Nergal kept Maya at his side throughout the rest of the afternoon, and she watched all the young faces, relaxed and happy, observing how much Nergal was like John, how people warmed to him and then were warm to each other, every occasion like a festival, touched by his grace. They poured each other's drinks, they fed Maya a big meal, all local, they talked with each other in their quick Martian English, detailing gossip and explaining their dreams. Oh, he was a special boy, all right. As fey as Hiroko, and yet utterly normal at one and the same time. Diana, for instance, was simply latched to his other side, and a lot of the other young women there looked like they wished they were in her place, or Maya's. Perhaps had been in the past. Well, there were some advantages to being an ancient babushka. She could mother him shamelessly, and he only grinned, and nothing they could do. Yes, there was something charismatic about him. Lean jaw, mobile, humorous mouth, wide-set, brown, slightly Asiatic eyes, thick eyebrows, unruly black hair, long, graceful body, though he wasn't as tall as most of them. Nothing exceptional. It was mostly his manner, friendly and curious and prone to hilarity.
This ends side one of cassette 15. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.